The name of the man I'm interviewing this week might not sound familiar, but when I talk about brands such as Goo, Freddy's Flowers, Dorset Cereals, Riverford, Abel & Cole, Clipper Tea, Yeo Valley, these are brands that Perry has worked with and helped shape. Perry Hayden Taylor, a man known for his branding brilliance and the founder of an award-winning brand and design and marketing consultancy, Big Fish, is my guest this week. Are you ready to be inspired and enlightened? Because that's exactly what this podcast is going to give you. Now, I have to confess, I'm utterly transfixed with Perry's wisdom and insights. I always have been. And a spoiler alert, he actually is the gentleman and Big Fish, the company responsible for the branding of Holly & Co. So we go back a long way, and it was just an amazing moment just to sit with what I have to say is a creative genius and hear about how he works, how he looks at brands, what he tries to relay to customers, how he has for 30 years been able to pull creativity out of founders. It's quite remarkable how he looks at mediums and questions why we're not all using everything that is at our fingertips to help grow our companies or our brands. This is one of those podcasts where within the first 10 minutes, you already know that you're going to play the podcast again. So if you don't have a pen and paper, get one, open your phone, get the notes out, because every, I would say, 2 minutes, there is a golden nugget that you're going to have to write down and then regurgitate all week until it's embedded into the future of whatever you're building, your dreams, your work, even the company you work for. It is a glorious hour. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I founded my first business, Not on the High Street, at 28, with a newborn strapped to my chest. Nearly 20 years on, he's all grown up, and I'm running my second business, Holly & Co. I've learned so much about taking risks, running a business, and some extraordinary life lessons along the way, and I know others have too. Yet despite the wealth of experience we have between us, lessons like this are often left unheard, and it can feel like we're travelling our paths alone. So I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. If you enjoyed this episode, might I ask you to share it with a friend and to like, subscribe, and review it so that together we can ignite people's passion across the UK. Now, let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Perry, it is lovely to be speaking to you today. It has been too long. I've wanted you on this podcast for many years, but welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
Well, you are a very, very lovely person for inviting me on, and I feel extremely privileged and slightly nervous.
Oh, well, Perry, there's nothing to be nervous. People are going to be hanging off your words. Now, for those of you who don't know Perry, Perry is the founder of Big Fish, an award-winning brand and design and marketing consultancy. Now, what I can't wait to tell people, Perry, because people are like, okay, well, everyone, just open up your cupboards, because this is the gentleman who's created a company behind the brands that you see, such as Dorset Cereals, Sipsmith, Goo, Charlie Bingham's, Tyrrells.
Yeah.
That's gone really well, hasn't it? I've had Charlie on the podcast. Brilliant.
Oh, I say, yes.
Tyrrells, Whole Earth, and the list goes on. And of course, Holly & Co. And
yes,
we've just been recounting how long ago it was that you were presenting back our logo.
Yeah,
and we're thinking it's 9 years ago now.
Yeah, I mean, I have no concept of time, but I do remember what an extraordinary... I've never had such sort of gold-clad, amazing clients walk in. It was like a party every time you came in, and you'd always bring presents, so we were absolutely crap. We were terrible, but Vicky did do that wonderful job for you, and you just, yeah, the reflected glory we take off you is clearly, that was amazing, and it was very sweet of you to even invite us to the party, which we feel very privileged to have been part of. Vicky sends her love, by the way.
Oh, how amazing. Amazing Vicky, who hand drew our logo. So for the last 30 years, you've been helping brands create, transform and grow their businesses as a force for good in the world. And we're going to sort of finish off the podcast talking about that. But in my opinion, creative genius, brand guru, you are joining us today. But I wanted to ask you, how has 2024 treated you so far? I mean, the sun is at least out, for God's sake. Thank God for that. It was feeling, I don't know about you, as I get older, I'm becoming that person who's slightly obsessed with the weather.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I'm always obsessed with the weather. We're so British, aren't we? But look, 2024, thank goodness, has been really kind to us, actually. So I'm feeling, I'm quite bouncy, couple of cups of coffee, bit of the old chalk. Really very, very good this year. And actually, you're very kind to use those words, but I'm sure most of that is sort of hyperbole. But it's, if that's the right word. But look, 24 has been great. We're bloody lucky. 23 wasn't great. So I think by contrast, I'm feeling extremely excited about this year, and we've been incredibly lucky. So yeah, kind of you to ask.
But 30 years in, you must have been used to the... Have you ever tried to... I remember someone saying about running a shop on the high street, you know, you try and create a melody, sort of understanding what's going to happen every March, what's going to happen every April. And someone said to me, throw that out the window, because I like, you know, efficiency and knowing. After 30 years, when you say 23 was bad and 24 has got off to a great start, did you have anything to do with that? Or is that sort of the way it happens?
Yeah, well, you know, the weird thing, it's funny you should ask that question. I mean, God, you're so insightful. I've noticed what you're amazing at. I've listened to all your amazing podcasts. Is you do seem to quickly get straight to some of the key issues. It's like, why did you do that? Why can't I do that? I mean, look, I think with a business like ours, just to explain to people who probably don't know who the hell I am, what we do, we're in the business of business. So we spend our entire lives trying to help people think out loud most of the time about the things that are going to challenge them and how to overcome those things. And I, you know, weirdly, you end up being sort of like a cobbler in shoes, not doing that for yourself enough. So, you know, sort of being the therapist, but not being kind of good at doing your own therapy. And I think where predictability and sort of the circumstances around how you can make a business successful or what you can do to mitigate risk ultimately is in just about everybody's control to some degree. And if you're not in control of it, then you've got to get in control of it. So I think the key thing for having a bad year is ultimately you've got no one else but yourselves to blame, because you need to adapt to the market, you need to adapt to the weather or whatever it is in whatever business you are. So last year was an entirely of our own doing cock up.
Really?
We just made some bad decisions, you know. And so I think in 30 years, every 7 years, and you mentioned the seasons, my thing is I forgot to read my notes that I always write to myself, and I write a lot. I mean, I think writing is thinking. And so because I've been lucky enough to have some amazing business partners, and I've been around doing this for a while, and I've always written to myself, because we don't have a proper board, you know, and advisors, we just sort of do the stuff ourselves. So I write it down, and then I read it, you know, at the same time every year to try and remind myself, because I don't have a chronology sort of automatically in my head of what's going on. And I forgot to do that last year. I kind of just got carried away, and we started making decisions that were completely out of kilter with what we would, our strategy. We just sort of started firing from the hip and doing stupid things. And sure enough, guess what? You know, we went off piste. We got caught out.
I love you being honest about that. You know, this is the thing on this podcast. It's those insights. It's those being able to say that. And actually, you know, for everyone listening, Perry, for them to go, Right. Okay. This is, if I had a set of principles or something that I wrote down, I kept reminding myself, am I on course? Aren't I on course? And, you know, life gets in the way. The admin gets in the way, doesn't it? All what we're doing.
Yeah.
Before we realize that, let me take you back. A few other facts about Perry, everyone, that if you read his Instagram, the bio reads husband, dad, crap musician, and chief stoker at Big Fish. You live in Somerset. You're a family man. I know that very well. And you appreciate typography so much so that your three daughters are named after typefaces, Perpetua, Helvetica, and Clarendon. And I just absolutely, well, I've loved you for so long. I want to go back to, well, you were born in 1966, and I read a little bit about your time at school.
Oh, God.
And this had me howling. I think the quote comes from one of your school reports, and it says, Perry sets himself abominably, can't even say the word, brilliant, how well I would have done at school, low targets that he continually fails to achieve.
Yeah, it's quite classic, isn't it?
Go on, tell me, school.
Yeah, I mean,
what
you know,
was it like? It didn't ignite your passion.
For me, school was a really weird experience because as a young man, I grew up in Jersey in the Channel Islands, which was the most idyllic place, son of a doctor and wonderful woman who my mum, they lived a very lovely life in Jersey as a GP and his wife. And so I was brought up with sort of no worries and it was crazy. You just spent my entire life on the beach and having a nice time. I then went to school, which really wasn't anything like being on the beach surfing and doing the stuff I like doing. So I fundamentally was incredibly bored by the work, but I loved the bits that around the work. I loved the, you know, friends and all that stuff. So yeah, I wasn't fit for purpose for the standard educational system. So I basically got the most appalling school reports. But my father, who was an academic, went to Oxford, you know, was really very bright, extraordinary. He was in the SES. You know, he was an incredible man and lovely man. And I just don't know how he managed to sort of tolerate this buffoon of a son. So, yeah, I mean, I think it shaped who I am, but probably in a sort of slightly odd way. But yeah, my school reports were terrible because basically I spent my entire life challenging conventional thought, not being that interested in what I was being taught and far more interested in stuff outside the window and, you know, other things.
Real life. I read you were interested in real life, but there was a teacher who inspired you, an art teacher called Robin Child.
Yeah.
What did he do for you that others hadn't?
So I think Robin Child is one of the great teachers of our time. And I think a lot of people discover their Robin Child. They'll have some teacher who saves them from a sort of fate worse than death, which is, you know, at school, my problem was, is that if I was at school today, they'd have probably diagnosed me with attention deficit. In fact, Peps, my eldest daughter, is convinced that I've got it. And I said, well, you know, I must go off and get it tested, et cetera. And she said, well, why would you do that? Because what difference is that going to make? And I'm like, good point. But I think at school, what happened was I didn't have the attention span. I couldn't really learn properly because I was probably eating all the wrong foods. I was jagged up on sugar and all the sort of stuff that one is. And because I went to boarding school, you have complete run of the mill. You do what you like. There's no real discipline, especially where I went to school. It was like a sort of male version of St. Trinian's. And so we just sort of did what we did. And then I failed dismally to get some good reports. And then I discovered art through Robin Child. And it wasn't art that I discovered. I mean, what it was that I discovered, he showed me how to see things. He gave me a framework within which to learn. And he used to do these amazing talks where he would explain all of the incredible things behind the artists of what had motivated them. And he would tell the stories and you'd sit there in this black, dark room with the curtains shut down at the basement of the art school. And there would be standing room only, because people would flock there and it was voluntary. You didn't have to go. This was just after lunch. And you'd hear the clunk click of the carousel of the slideshow. And I just remember the sound. It was just magical. And at that moment, I was totally absorbed. And I kind of, then he would teach us to draw in these amazing drawing classes. And he would just talk the whole way through, you know, very gently talk about, you know, just basically coaching you and telling you about all the things you need to think about the weight of the line and how to observe. And he was just amazing. I saw him amazingly, you know, I reconnected because he had an exhibition of his work last year. It's one of the highlights of last year, back at Marlborough College, which is where he taught. And he'd never done an exhibition of his own work. And it was his life's work. And he was incredible. I had lunch with him, and his daughter, Lauren, is a great friend of mine. We worked together. She came and worked with us at Big Fish. And he said, you know what, Perry? I'm doing my best work now. This is incredible. And he's still inspiring people. And he was. You know, he's just brilliant. And I think that's what you want in life, is you want somebody to just want you to succeed.
Yeah.
Who really sees in you things that other people don't and gets
Absolutely.
The best out of you without having to sort of berate you.
And also, I think just a little bit, maybe, you know, as we get older, you know, we get more tired and all these sorts of things. And I'm sure after 30 years, you know, there's just a physicality. There's a thing that is draining. But I met someone today, Sir John Hegarty. And,
oh, wow.
You know, he just said he's turning 80 this year. And there he was, full of beans, giving me such wisdom. And he said, I think I'm more excited than ever for this year.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I've just built myself a runway. The end is not near. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm looking at someone who is, and I think it's a really important thing for those of us who are working so hard, doing this for a long time, to have these people who are wiser, older, and telling us those things. So you spoke that you were at Marlborough College, and I know this does come up time and time again about the teacher. So Keith Brimer-Jones spoke about an epiphany moment he had with his art teacher. So Tim Smith spoke about how he believes that teachers can literally change the world by installing this sort of sense of hope and possibility and passion in their pupils. And as you said, everyone needs or should have a Robin Child. You went from Marlborough College as studying art A-level before getting into St Martin's School of Art. Was that the period of time where you discovered your passion for typography? And am I right in saying that you thought it should be part of the national curriculum?
Yeah, I still do. Look, yeah, tell you what, all of those people are right. John Hegarty is a legend. I was lucky enough to meet him once when I was working with Bowdoin, and he won't remember, but those people have got energy that is just out of this world, and they inspire people around them because they're great teachers. I mean, John's a great teacher. He's got an amazing course that he's done. I mean, he's yes. extraordinary. So yeah, I think you look for people in life. My advice is look for people in life who inspire you and who you can learn from. And never stop trying to qualify for the job. And actually, there's a thing called the Dreyfus model, which is, I don't really know much about, but I'm kind of using it here to try and work out, you know, how do you know how good you are? And the Dreyfus model, I think, goes that you have sort of five stages of competency, I suppose. You start off as a novice, you then become competent, you then become proficient. I think it's that way around.
Mm-hmm.
You then become expert, and then you become a master. And the way that you explain, you know, those, how do you know which of those you are? It all starts with when you're a master, everything becomes second nature and you can just jam it. You know, you can just wing it because it's all in there.
The Rolling Stones.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you are, you don't think about it. Everything's intuitive. But when you're a novice, you're on this incredible steep learning curve and you're absorbing it like a sponge. And you probably think you're better than you are because, you know, it's a bit like, you know, I've just taken up golf.
You need it slightly, don't you, to even get through the pain of your learning.
Yeah, I think, in fact, I believe that there's a sort of weird thing. So about that epiphany, I think the first thing is if you're a novice at something and you're so absorbed that you go very quickly through from novice to competent to proficient, which probably got this the wrong way around, that speed of learning is the epiphany moment for me. It's like you just suddenly get hooked and some things hook you in. And especially for someone like me, you know, it's a bit like Toad Hall. It's like, oh, shiny new thing. Oh, hello. I think, you know, I'm going to become a movie maker. You know, oh, you know. So it's like, oh, you know, my children are despair at this because I'm, you know, our house is just like this. Well, you've been there, you know.
I've been there, the pottery wheels.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, I mean, those biscuits, so just for your listeners, Holly turned up at my house And I mean, like,
I was trying to woo him.
No, you were brilliant. It was incredible. And she turned up with this entire sort of extraordinary cornucopia of amazing stuff that you'd made and bought and curated. And you'd actually baked.
It was a basket full of a picnic, wasn't it?
It was incredible.
I had a grass tablecloth.
Yeah. And then you'd baked my children.
Gabby, my co-founder,
You'd baked my children's names in the typeface that their name is in biscuits. I mean, what the hell? That was mad. It's brilliant. Anyway, where was I? Classic distraction. Yeah, that's right. So the whole of the kind of exciting new things and having an epiphany, because you've got to try a lot of different things before you know. Mm. You know, you've got, and that's where I went to St. Martin's School of Art on a foundation course. And the foundation course is basically like a sort of sampler. It's like, oh, I'll have a little amuse-bouche, I'll try a bit of this, try a bit of that. And you kind of go, I fucking hate that, you know. And actually, also, Robin was an amazing painter and he taught us to paint. And I thought I was going to be a painter. And you couldn't get me out of the art school. I would, you know, I'd sniff oil paints, not get high. I would just sniff it. The smell, everything absorbed me. And I was in that incredibly sort of foggy, in love with painting for years. You know, I was obsessed and I just loved it. And I got to St. Martin's on the first sort of week of the foundation, kind of went, to be honest, probably a bit of a cocky twat, you know, thinking, well, I know I'm a bloody good painter. And I was shit. And the point was, it wasn't because I was a crap at technically painting, I could do that. I had nothing to say because I was just a middle class nobody, you know, who had a sort of sheltered life. And the people next to me had interesting, you know, they had real lives.
Yeah.
They weren't some sort of sheltered middle class
slum.
Well, you know, one guy had lost he was in his late 20s and a mature student. You know, I think he'd lost a relative in the Northern Ireland conflict. There were people there who had come from the real world and their paintings, they didn't give a shit about the technical, you know, oh, I'll put the orange next to the blue and have complementaries. Yeah, bullets like that. They just painted how they felt and they do these big canvases. And I was like, whoa, I really felt inept actually. And I kind of thought, shit, I'm not a painter. I'm just a technician. And then I looked around and I found some wooden type trays in the hall and I saw the typography that was going on. I was like, and I saw letters for the first time being used by real professionals and Central St. Martin's, it was actually St. Martin's then, but then later on it became Central St. Martin's, had this amazing sort of typography department. And I got the same bug. It just hit me. I was like, typefaces, oh my God. I couldn't tell you why. And I'm not even a very good typographer. That's the brutal honest truth. But then I really loved it. And I think that's the thing is you see something and you're just, your intuition is there's something amazing about that. And the reason I think typography should be part of the national curriculum is how do we all communicate these days? We don't spend our lives on podcasts and microphones.
No.
We write.
Yeah.
We use letters. And Steve Jobs was a typographer. I didn't realize that until later. You know, and that's what made Apple great. If he hadn't been a typographer, if he hadn't dropped out and gone to typography course, I genuinely don't think Apple would have been Apple. So I just think it's amazing.
Isn't that incredible? I'd never, never thought of that. I'm interested because you went from this, so you got your love of type. So you became a freelance designer working at the BBC, Unilever, then The Guardian.
Yeah, not really The Guardian, more The Punch magazine. I got fired from The Guardian in one day. Because I went to the pub and got pissed and there's basically, the layout has got a blank space. I think I found it on the, literally missed the deadline. Yeah, but I work for Punch magazine.
You want to say to our young, don't you, do something like that. Because in 30 years' time, when you're on a podcast, it's bloody funny to be able to say that.
But
you had an entrepreneurial streak and you were involved in a few startups and you've stated that they failed miserably.
Some, yeah.
But the thing is, you maintain that this was incredibly valuable experience. What do you think failure teaches us, and especially in those early days? So if you're talking about your being a novice and moving through the ranks, I'm assuming you're feeling that failure is a necessity to going through the ranks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, you know, a failure is not just, I mean, it's essential. Because if you think about it, how on earth are you going to ever do anything unless you know what doesn't work. So we have a thing actually that we've, it was actually lovely Jamie Campbell who came and worked here recently. And it, years and years of working in this business, we do three things. You know, first of all, we run a business that helps businesses. So it's not sort of like a, you know, arts and crafts shop. Our job is to help people ultimately get noticed, get their brands noticed, and then to, you know, sell more stuff and hopefully do that in a way that's kind of relatively low impact or has some sort of positive impact. And so you look at the first thing is you're like, you know, what are we trying to do here? That's the first thing. And you can't just go in and go, oh, it's great. You know, you're such a good product. You know, it's amazing. If you just talk about all the positives, all you do is you're just deluding yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, we did it with you, remember? And we were like, you know, yeah, but that's great. I mean, we're sold, you know, we're here now. So we have this thing, you walk in the room and go like, you know, actually, should we just talk about all the stuff that's not working?
Yeah.
And Jamie Campbell, I remember, he's a lovely guy, really bright bloke, came in. He said, actually, do you know what? When you criticize work, you should never say, I like that or I don't like that. You should always say, it works because, or it doesn't work because you could be objective against a brief. And actually, I said, you know, I wish someone told me that bloody 25 years ago or 30.
Yeah.
Because actually, he was right. We've adopted it immediately. And the reason I think the list of mistakes is so important is it tells you what's right. You don't know what's right until you know what's not right.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, you know, everyone knows this is a cliche, but, you know, I just think that failure is one of the great universities. And if you make mistakes, you learn from them. And the biggest mistake is to not learn from them and to continue to make them again.
Mm.
And that's what we did last year. You know, we didn't learn from our mistakes and we made it again. So,
and you made it again. Yeah. How do you personally, I won't ask where you think you are on your levels, but how do you personally, after 30 years, deal with failure? Do you feel you're better equipped now to deal with failure than when, let's say, you started Big Fish?
Yes. I mean, I think people are very hard on themselves. In fact, quite a lot of people sort of go, you know, people like me in this business are probably quite even harder on themselves than most because it's the kind of curse of a creative, isn't it? To sort of constantly, relentlessly pursue better, not because you're, you know, it's just a sort of disease.
Yeah, a turmoil.
No, it is a turmoil because that's the point about any kind of designer, for example, if you take the design aspect of what we do, you're trying to constantly look for how you can improve things. Well, that never stops. You're just always in beta mode. You're always constantly going, well, you know, and the only reason you stop is because someone's got a deadline. And then the feedback loop is something goes out. Like say, for example, your website, you know, if you've got an e-com website, you're constantly seeing what works and what doesn't work. So you want to know that things are not working because then you know there's more to go for.
One of the things I'm most proud of at Holly & Co. is the fact that over 90% of the small businesses that sell on our marketplace are female founded. It means that every time you shop with us, you are voting with your money for the kind of world you want to live in. By supporting women-owned businesses, you're backing the idea of flexible working, showing the next generation what's possible, and actively championing the female economy. It means that despite only 2 pence of every pound's worth of funding in the UK going to women, and women still being the primary caregivers, we are rising above and finding a new way to live our way. You can support female-founded businesses by looking out for the badges on our marketplace. In fact, we have lots of ways to shop by your values, from choosing black-owned businesses or socially positive businesses to products that are made of recycled material or made here in the UK. Find out more at Holly & Co. For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. Big Fish, I feel, has a real startup mentality and still, you know, still does. And it's incredible, the brands that you've worked on. And I'm going to talk more about those in a minute. But I would love you to take me through the story for those who are listening and understanding those sort of three principles that you just spoke about there, what you did with goo. Because the famous and bloody delicious pudding that we all know and love, and initially it was called the Belgium Chocolate Company.
Mm.
And How did you go from that to Goo? And what was that journey of the idea behind that little glass pot in the sleek genius packaging like it is now? Because I think it's a classic great story of almost, you know, encapsulating what you bring.
Yeah, I've been dining out on that one for a few years. I think, look, first of all, any business, whether it's Goo or any other, starts with a founder with a vision who is going to basically challenge conventional wisdom in some way, shape or form. And Jim Arvidik, who is an absolute classic, I love him to bits, you know, rocks up at our place very early on. I think sort of, you know, year not that many, because I can't tell you, like, I have no idea of chronology. Yeah. I can't tell you if it was last year or 5 years, 10 years ago. But anyway, it was like 20 odd years ago. And he comes in and he was introduced to me by Charlie Bigham, who said, look, you go and see Perry and Big Fish guys. And he said, look, I've spotted a gap, which is the first thing they do. They spot a sort of gap in a Fool's car park. And he said, if you look at the desserts category, I want to start a business. I'm going to call it the Belgian Chocolate Company, because there are no premium desserts on the shelf. There's just sort of shitty crap in plastic pots, like made by Cadbury's or whatever. He said, I've been living in Belgium and you can get some really great quality chocolate mousse. And I've also made this amazing chocolate fondant, sort of like a souffle. So what happened was I went away. I thought, okay. I remember being up about 4 a.m. in the morning, because we didn't really have anyone working. It was myself, Lisa, and a couple of others at Big Fish. And I was thinking, God, I've got to present this work. So I basically came up with this name, Goo, which was G-U with an umlaut, like a smiley face. I thought, wow, I've got it. This is great. You know, my instinct was, this is it. We've nailed it. Two letters, great little mark. You know. And I mocked up the brand, the packaging, and I made it all up. And then I went to go and present to Jim in our studio and said to Jim, look, before I present this, I just want to show you the competitive set, the marketplace, and then I'm going to show you the work we've done. And he was like, okay, great, take it away. And I did this sort of slideshow. And I said, look, so first of all, you've got these people and these people. I think Innocent had just launched, baby, and that kind of stuff. Mm. And I said, so, and look, they're these Belgian dudes called Goo. And I put the photos of the packaging up and stuff. And I said, yeah, and they're really great. Oh, my God, these guys are incredible. They've got this mantra, which is their chocolate extremists and dollop of fun. They're all about, it's only for adults. They've literally banned children or anything to do with this brand. You know, it's like, this is too good for kids. Give them an apple, tell them bugger off. You know, it was all about this stuff. And I was just laying it on things. I said, no, they've gone to this photographer, this kind of fashion photographer, who normally sort of photographs $10,000 watches. You know, he's a luxury fashion photographer, and they've given him their chocolate pudding, which, by the way, isn't exactly the same, coincidentally, the same glass that you use. And they've said, make it look $1 million. And they've shot it on these incredible, and it's incredible. You know, I've never seen anything like this. And they were, and he was going, Jesus. And I'm sorry, I'm going to swear. He said, fuck, yeah, fuck. That is fucking exactly what I was wanting. That is incredible. He said, I can't believe it. And I went, I know, it's fucking crazy, isn't it? It's brilliant. I said, anyway, look, I'm feeling a bit awkward about presenting the work, but yeah. And of course, you know, I then said, look, good news, Jim, is that's actually your brand, but you know, took you out of your comfort zone. And what's brilliant though, Holly, I don't know if you know this bit of the story, is he was like, that's amazing. So he was excited and he's a great guy. 3 days later, he comes back. He said, Perry, really sorry, but actually, do you know what? We think it's a shit name. And I know I thought it was great, but actually I've spoken to a friend of mine's a brand expert called Charlotte or somebody, I can't remember her name. And, you know, she's given me this whole letter, and he sent me some email about, you know, black is the color of death. Goo stands for genitourinary, you know, goo clinics, you know, 1,000 reasons why we shouldn't do it. And I went, okay, well, first of all, maybe you should have gone to her to do your branding, you know, not me. And second of all, come this way. I took him down to Waitrose and I just mocked up 20 packs and put them in store with not even asking Waitrose. It was very naughty on the King's Road. And I just sort of basically cleared everything off the desserts fixture, put the packs on the shelf, and then said, look, let's just watch this, shall we? And the store manager came out. I was like, you know, what's going on here? And then we got chatting to him. So, you know, we're thinking about this brand. And he was like, oh, wow, it's amazing. And then someone walked along with a basket full of Charlie Bigham's. Did look like a setup. Wasn't one. I was like, oh, what is this? This is amazing. Anyway, Jim and I stood there. And, you know, frankly, yeah, he was like, yeah, this is great. Yeah, okay. And I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, that's how it works. And so, yeah, it was a good story.
It's how it works, but there is this thing that you do, which is that you the way you just, you know, and I'm sure everyone was just following you and then realizing what you were saying. You were presenting back the idea to the client as if someone else had done it.
Yep.
But just even if you dissect it, taking the fashion photography to the glass, to the not allowing children to have it, to all these things, this is what you do. And it is literally phenomenal. And it's what made me drive to your house and beg you with biscuits and, you know, to work with us because you get it. And I think that one of the things that you get is this ability for a brand to be so much more than the chocolate mousse. You suddenly put fashion, you suddenly put sexy into that. You suddenly had that sort of, you know, we all know the story of innocent and two flat plump nuns on the ingredients, or don't look at my bottom on the bottom of the bottle. You've done this for Yeo Valley, you've done it for Riverford, Abel & Cole, Clipper Tea, Goo, the list goes on. What is it that you see that other people don't? Why do you see a brand identity? How can you get under the skin the way that you do?
Well, it's very kind of you to say that. And it makes it sound a lot better
well,
than it is.
It's 100% true.
Look, I think the key with all of this is to, you know, trying to define one's recipe for success is really hard. And a lot of it is instinctive. It's that five stages. It's the sort of doing it a lot. So you trust your instinct. And if you read Malcolm Gladwell and all these amazing books, pretty much there's a whole school of thought. You know, I mean, you probably buy one of any 100 books that will tell you, trust your instincts, you know, look at it on a blink, all that kind of stuff. But I think for me, the best way for, you know, because your listeners, you know, you're all about inspiring people. By the way, Holly, you are incredible. You inspire so many people. And I think that the danger with people like us, which is that you kind of, we're in the same game, aren't we? We're trying to inspire people to go out to take some serious risks and actually, you know, live a bloody difficult life, but you know, hopefully a fun one. And I think that the thing is to understand what consumers, you know, which is a horrible word, but what people in the real world really love and, you know, what they're drawn to. And I think that if you start to try and formulate a formula for success, you do tend to write rules that then make things become not very attractive because they're not different. What people want, I think most of the time, they want to be different just like everyone else. You know, they want enough difference. And so when you look at those brands, for example, that you talk about, I mean, number one, they're all aesthetically pleasing. You know, they just look nice. So if you're going to use food, for example, if you're going to package food or design something to try and get someone to eat something, then, you know, for God's sake, make it look tasty. So I think it's about heightening the experience, and that's making the right choice. We call it, you know, making the right choice, the easy choice or the desirable choice. But actually, there's a lot more to it than that, because the psychology of making the decision is what I think our recipe for success is. And we've just done this incredible project this week. I'm going to use this example. Sorry, I'm darting around.
Yeah, please.
So a lovely couple who have come to us with a drink. And this one is called Lonquero. So this is a great story. And you're the first. This is no one's.
This is an exclusive, everybody.
Because it's literally hot off the press. It's not even out.
What is it called?
Okay, I can tell you. Big old. So this is called Lonquero. Lonquero, it's a Finnish drink. So in 1952, the Olympic Summer Games in Finland, in Helsinki, were happening, and the government over there, quite stringent on booze, gave a license to, I think, the breweries or the booze manufacturers to make a new drink. And they came up with this idea of a long drink, which is soda, a little bit of gin, some grapefruit, pink grapefruit, a touch of pine, and a little smash of lime. So this is somewhere between the sort of cider and beer thing and a gin and tonic, I suppose. Anyway, long story short, Joe and Paige, the founders of this business, they saw an opportunity, thought, you know what, we can bring this finished drink to England. And they came in a few weeks ago and we've teamed up with them, partnered up with them. And they said, you know, they gave us the brief and we really got inside their head and we spent, 6 hours in a room with them on one day, more hours before, 6 hours just talking about this drink and saying, you know, what is it and why are we doing it? And we're asking these questions and lots of questions of them. And it came out, I think they were exhausted. And we then went away And we presented the work last week as a film, and they came into this room that I'm in now, which is, you know, it's a big meeting room. We have lots of, we put all the posters up, and basically we turned the whole room into the world of Longhero. And we designed these cans and ads and films and posters, and the rallying cry we came up with, well, first of all, we described how do you describe this drink? Because no one knows what it tastes like. Is it a beer? Is it a wine? What is it? And we came up with a line, which is, it's like leaping naked into a freezing Finnish fjord on a cold February fresh day. And then we've got this picture of the leaping naked people leaping into kind of fjords with the rallying cry of pants off, enjoy yourself. And you know, anyway, so I was like a bit of a winger. We only give them one route. We just double down on it and we went for it. And they walked in, film's going crazy, the noise, the music's on and it's all good. And they just sat there and they were like, we bloody love it. We bloody love it. And they haven't changed one thing. And it's incredible. Wow. And the team are going, gosh, shan't we show them options? Can't we show them too little, too much? That's right. I said, no, fuck it. You know.
Yeah.
It's not like children. You have to have one favorite. Mm.
Yeah. You do have to have one favorite. But that is the thing. You did the process with us and you dissected what we wanted to do and who we were speaking to and what was the message that we wanted them to feel. And it's one of the things that you do. And when I spoke to David Hyatt, he spoke
He's
about
amazing.
The magic ingredient called emotional, you know, commerce. And we were talking about, you know, he said it's 18 inches from your head to your heart. And that's the most extraordinary brands take you on that journey of those 18 inches. Mm. And I do believe that that's what you do as well, that you are able to get into the psyche of people. You excite people. I was talking to John Vincent from Lyon.
Oh, yes.
And we were talking about the vanilla-ness that's going on out there.
Blandification, I call it.
Blandification.
Blander for bloodication.
Tell me about what that is, because then I want to go on to packvertising. But tell me about blandification, because if it's okay, I will quote you always, but I'm now going to use
that. Good.
Because I'm using like a 1950s word, vanilla.
Yeah, the blandification. What drives me crazy is the fact that so many, I don't want to sound negative, because actually, you know, the world's just full of amazing people and creative people, but what happens, I think, is that phrase earlier, you know, this idea that everyone wants to be different, just like everyone else. There's that wonderful Derek Sivers TED talk. I don't know if you've seen it. It's about 3 minutes long. It's really good. I play it all the time to people where it's basically at a festival on the side of a hill. It's a very sort of shaky mobile phone. And there's this guy, sort of lunatic guy, dancing off his face. He's sort of really doing his wacky dancing. And everyone's sitting on there, you know, probably drinking the equivalent of Longhero. And they're all sort of having a nice time. But they're looking at him, laughing at him, you know, kind of poor chap. But he's having a good time and doing crazy dance. And then this other guy gets up behind him and dances with him, you know, and he's the first follower. And then in 3 minutes, literally 3 minutes, you see the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth. And then suddenly there are 15, and suddenly there are 40, and then suddenly there are 50. And suddenly there are loads of people dancing, and there are less people on the sitting there watching and laughing than there are dancing. And you've reached that tipping point, and suddenly everyone is dancing, and the people who are sitting down are feeling awkward, and they're the ones who look a bit bloody stupid. And you've just seen an incredible transformation, and that's how brands work, is that somebody goes out, does something interesting, and then everyone follows them. And I think the great blandification is that, you know, your brand's buggered and people just copy the normal stuff. They appear, they show up in the category and go, oh, you know, hello, I want to look like a yogurt. I'm going to look like, and everyone judges the stuff by what everything looks like. And of course, what happens is you just blandify, and then they take all the fun out, and then some boring, bland manager comes along, you know, who's in a dull as ditch water and doesn't want to lose their job and go, oh, actually, we're going to scale this. It needs to be more mass market. What we need to do is reach another 5 million people, and they don't want different. They like the same, you know. And so they'll just take all of the joy out of it. They'll completely fuck the brand, and then, you know, it'll be bought back for a quid, and it'll go, you know, go round again. So, you know, I'm so cynical. Sorry, that I should just.
Yeah, no, I'm bitter. With you, God. I'm with you. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is what I've been talking about to anyone that I've met this week. That's been our common denominator conversation.
Angry so how old funny people that we're going, why are they
how funny
the
is
world?
That we're having this conversation as well. But it's more when you've seen the cycle so many times that it's just ridiculous. So blandification, so that's happening out there. And what you do is bring some joy back into these
well, hopefully.
Brands. Into if we think back to the advertising days, you know, my life started in advertising. And someone recently, I can't remember the brand, it was a smaller brand, and their whole line was, we can't afford horses or something. And it was going up against, it was a beer brand, going up against the great Guinness, ad with the horses, right? And I, again, talking to Sir John Hegarty, you know, he was talking about today Levi's and how it was only, they were only worn in the summer and until you changed that sort of thing. These were the days where big, bold statements were being made. There was creativity, fun. TV advertising was just phenomenal.
Very glamorous.
At one stage.
Yeah, it was
glamorous. It was all those sorts of things. We've now sort of, not only have we blandified brands, but also we've got so many mediums that we've got to turn up on. It's very difficult for brands to operate in so many arenas well. Yeah. You know, so that's again why things are watered down, I think, because we've got too much to service.
Well, I mean, look, and also you've made a very, very good point there about scalability, because brands or businesses or whatever you want to call them, they have to go through different stages of growth. So they start off in the discovery phase, where whether there's, is this going to work? They then go into a validation phase, they call it, the investors call it, which is, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what we were talking about earlier. And then, of course, it's a bit like a sort of a balloon. If you blow up a balloon, it's got a weakness in it, you're going to blow up the weakness, it's going to, and it's going to pop. So you want to go to that efficiency stage, that third phase of kind of looking at what works and what doesn't work, and then making it efficient so that you can then scale it. You don't want to scale it with inefficiency.
Yeah.
You know, and then it gets to the stage where it's growing like a weed and everyone's excited. You know, Uber's launched, or, you know, Airbnb, or the big brands, or even this, you know, it's lovely small brands, which are probably more interesting. And then they get to a point where they need money and they can't scale fast enough, because all of the lovely people that have helped them get to where they've got to are not going to be the people who help them get to the next bit. We want to try and retain that lovely essence of specialness. But what they tend to do is hire people who are a bit lazy, if I'm honest, about, like, you know, I can't be bothered to sit for 17 hours in a room talking shit. You know, I just need to get it done. And my culture of the company won't allow us to do complex stuff because we have to scale it. And then they blandify it, and then it becomes, you know, it becomes bland, and they scale it. And so they can scale it because it's simple. Have to have a cookie cut approach. And then, of course, you get your multiple channels that you're talking about, which is they have to invest in so many different channels. They can't afford to keep any one of those beautifully furnished with the most amazing, crafted, mastered, gorgeous stuff. Whereas in the old days, just tele ads, you know, that's fine.
Put all your money into one side, or two or three focuses.
You know,
so
focus is absolutely key. I mean, One of the companies, that the most inspiring company I've worked with recently, I mean, many, but one is called Picnic, which no one will have heard of over here because it's in the Netherlands and it's in France and it's in Germany. And we've just created a range of 2,000 products for them. 2,000.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, incredible. And it's taken 3 years. And there's an amazing, it's honestly, it's the most amazing story. I have to tell it because it is so inspiring. This chap called Joris turns up, who's ex, you know, FMCG, really bright guy, Dutch guy, and says, look, I'm starting a new business. This is 7 or 8 years ago, a new business, or I've started one. I mean, it's a bit like Ocado. He said, I've looked at the supermarket grocery industry, which I've been in for years, I've known, and actually I asked the question that we all ask, we think is great, is, you know, what would you do if you were to start this category again from scratch? That's what we call the startup mentality question. And it's the best question you can ask of any brief. And he said, and what you wouldn't do is have stores. You know, the worst place for groceries is sitting on a shelf, getting old in a big warehouse or in a big supermarket and getting people to drive to the supermarket. I mean, for God's sake, it's ridiculous. You would never do that if you were to reinvent it. So you'd have an Ocado, you'd have a direct, no-store business. And he worked out all of the most amazing algorithms for how they could optimize delivery. And they basically use milk floats. And it was kind of his idea was like, we need to bring back the milkman and have these rounds around Amsterdam where we're going to deliver an electric, you know, very sustainably. We're going to deliver groceries to people and we're going to get the right things to them in the right way. And it's going to be 80% less negatively impactful. It's going to be really, really positively impact the issue. I'm sorry, I really messed that up. It's going to be better. Right. Anyway, so I was like, okay, so what do you want us to do? So, well, we don't have any of our own label range. We just sell Coca-Cola and all the stuff. But he said, yeah. This isn't posh. I want to sell to, you know, normal people, doctors, nurses, fire, people who have real jobs in the real world who make the world go round. And I said, great. Okay. And his team came over and we spent weeks trying to work out a strategy for them, with them. And it was very much a collaboration. I can't take credit for all this. I'll take some reflected glory there. And we said, look, what do you do differently? And we came up with a really great insight, which was, why should people on a budget be made to feel like second-class citizens? If you go to Tesco and you haven't got any money, you have to buy the shit-looking stuff that's in white and blue, and you're reminded every day that you haven't got as much money as the people buying the nice stuff.
Yes.
That's shit. Because there's more people who haven't got money than have.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, his team are amazing. He only hired people with zero category experience. He said, I don't want anyone who's ever worked at a supermarket. He just hired really bright people.
Brilliant.
That's amazing. He said, because they won't come with any preconceived ideas.
Yes.
I mean, it's crazy. And we even said, right, we're not calling them buyers. And they were really great fun. They are brilliant fun. They were here yesterday. And he said, right, what should we do? And I said, well, what about we don't call them buyers? Why don't we give them names? He says, well, great. We call them sheriffs. and the whole thing was disruptive and wonderfully chaotic, but also really efficient. And so the range that we created is currently 2,000 we've done to date, own label products. And we said, right, we want no corporate identity, no consistency, everything's different. So it all looks completely, and we've designed it for the home. And honestly, I'll send you a link to the film. We've made it.
Oh my
goodness. Honestly, this stuff
goodness.
Will blow your mind. It is the most beautiful work. And actually, we ended up illustrating everything. So we've had about 2,000 illustrations, and they're all different. Everything, whether it's loo roll, whether it's cat litter, whether it's crisps, it is bonkers.
Unbelievable.
And the good news is that the supply chain that they have, they're really, really diligent about trying to, the big long word, disintermediate, to try and, shorten the supply chains, to try and get rid of the, the unnecessary, and they're one of these businesses. They're so googly, they're growing like a weed. And they're in Germany, yeah. They're in France, they're in Amsterdam, they'll probably be in other countries. And they have been, it's insane, honestly. And they were here yesterday and they party hard as well. So anyway, that is for me, the kind of the next generation of the opposite of bland managers. You've got people going in there and Joris is similar to me and Michiel, his business partner, and Frederick, they are visionaries. And they're like, those people are what we need in the world.
Each week, I hand this ad break over to our partners at Royal Mail. And this week, I'm here to talk about returns. Now, if you're a small business owner, this is highly likely to be on your radar, as the smoother the process is, the more happy customers you are likely to have. Did you know that independent research from Mintel said that 81% of online shoppers agree that a good returns experience would make them more likely to shop with a retailer in the future? And that's why a seamless service is so important. Royal Mail can offer a range of solutions depending on your needs, so that you can then relist and resell your items. Plus, if a customer has paid the return, chosen to use Parcel Collect, and booked a collection, then the postie will even pick it up from their home or nominated safe place at no extra cost. To find out more about making your returns process smoother, just head to the Royal Mail Small Business Hub on royalmail.com. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration. You must have had I love these stories, by the way.
Sorry,
it's
I'm
literally,
on the top of the
I think
crap.
Actually we could, I think everyone is crying out for us to just spend another 5 hours and you just tell us every single okay. story that you have. But I want to ask you, what you're talking about there, that essence of those mavericks, those who are looking to change things. And one of the things I think is that when listening to this podcast, if you're a small business, you're thinking about growing, is that, okay, well, that's fine, but I don't have any money and I'm in that novice phase and I'm growing and I'm trying to make ends meet and all these sorts of things. And what I loved when we worked with you was this understanding that everything you do. So when we came in, everyone, we walked up into the room that Perry's in right now, and on the table were bottles with our logo on it. There was our posters of Holly & Co. with people making with their hands on the wall. And there was all this attention to detail. It was unbelievable. And that's what you do, which is this understanding that every single touch point is advertising.
Yeah.
Every single. And you have a great video, I don't know if it's still on your website, about packvertising and this concept. And I think those who are a small business, we can get hold of that because guess what? We're nimble, quick-minded folk who can now, literally after this podcast, they're going to go and do something with this knowledge. Talk to me about everything being marketing.
Yeah, well, look, this is the secret sauce that isn't secret, but is oft forgotten. If you're a small business, and by the way, everyone should think like a startup, no matter how big they are, or small they are, because that's the world we live in and we're moving fast. Mm. So I think if your riches lie in the lack of your resources. So I've just twisted my father's favorite phrase, which was his riches lie in the lack of his requirements. But look, your riches lie in the lack of resources because if you haven't got very much, you've got to make what you've got work, as you said. And ultimately, there's a ton of stuff around that you can use to try and reach people. So you've got to make some choices because you would never in a million years be able to use all of them. So I think, if you're selling food and it happens to be in a pack, like, Picnic, for example. Okay, so let's go back. Let's go to someone who hasn't got any money. Loncaro. Mm-hmm. You've got to make the pack really earn its keep because it's the only advertising you can afford. So what I said years ago to Dorset Cereals, and I mean, I say it all the time, is like, just think of everything as an advert, not just, everything. The conversations you have are conversation advertising. If you send out a survey to someone and say, what do you think of our products? Don't just like, what do you think of our products? It's a bloody advert. You're actually engaging them and you've got their mind. I mean, David Hyatt is an absolute legend at this. He is the master of this.
Agree.
So you should spend more time on your submit button than you should on your, you should just spend a lot of time on the detail. I mean, Holly, you are you're a guru at this. You know how to do it. You've got a podcast, for God's sake, that, it's really great ways. Everything you do is marketing. And I don't think the world is any different to how it has always been. People have to become aware of you. They have to be able to get their hands on what it is you're doing, whether it's digital or physical. They need to get there and they need to be able to try it before they buy it. They need to be able to, expect to compare it with stuff, evaluate it. And then when they do eventually buy or commit, even if it's something that's free, you've then got to follow that up and say thank you. Thank you for doing that, to remind them that what they've just, the choice they've made was a good choice. And so I think a lot of the post-sale is forgotten as well, that sort of following up.
Yes.
And of course, in the world of digital and on e-commerce, that's been automated for everyone. That's brilliant. You get these incredible, AI now is kind of weird, but you can really, really show gratitude. And people like to do business with people they like. you can have two companies, one selling a shit product or not, slightly less good product, and one selling a better product. And actually they'll go with the one that they like, even if it's slightly less good than the one that is better because they like them.
When you look at this, when you're looking at the landscape now, Perry, and you're talking about this change, So we're talking about brands changing here. You think consumers are changing as well?
Oh, yeah.
as much? And, you know, when we were working together, it was all about that voting with your money, you know, spending that pound on your values and casting that vote. Do you think that that is ever more important as a brand nowadays? This isn't a nice to have. I think we all really understand that. But you've been backing businesses that have been doing good for the world or changed something for the better for a long time.
Well, not as long as we should have done, to be fair. And just to be super clear, you know, I don't want to come across as some sort of greenwashing charlatan, but this was a really big change for us. When Peps, my eldest, sent me an essay by William McDonough, and it was written in the year 2000. It was a visionary essay about circularity. And, you know, it told us all 24 years ago what we should do, and everyone ignored it. And now we look back and I cringe. I really cringe about not having been curious enough to have read that. And, you know, when Pen, I think she was 14 when she sent it, and it fundamentally changed our view, because we thought, okay, we're not intentionally going out to kind of, you know, mess up the world. But actually, if you look back at the companies we've worked with, we've all been guilty of doing some horrific things, but we were all naive and we all were misinformed. And so, you know, I don't want to sort of suggest that we're in some sort of way, you know, doing any good at all. I think we're doing less bad. But I think if you want to be able to articulate it, the way that I see it is we're working with companies, and we seek to work with companies that are going to try and displace not good with better. So where we've come up to is we need to work with companies that are big enough to make a difference. They're willing to change. I think there are four ways you can make things change. I think the first is investors, where people put their money, and we need to change investment policy. So investors, where they put their money, number one, they're the most key thing. The second thing is they've got to back the right innovations, you know, and the innovations are things like, you know, controlled environment production to try and free land up. You've got investors and innovators, but they're no use if the governments aren't helping them with policy. You've got to make it law. You know, you can't just expect the investment community and innovators to do it. So the policymakers, we've got to work with them to try and make sure that they make the right choice, the legal choice. And then finally, us consumers, who frankly would love to, you know, buy the right things and not have to worry about these things, we're pretty, you know, I think I always used to be of the view of, like, you can vote with your money and make the green vote. The sad thing is, Holly, only about 4 or 5% people are driven by ethics in certain food categories. Very few will, especially since lockdown and the recession, very few consumers actually do that. And, you know, you can't blame them. They're just humans. And so I think what we have to do is to recognize those four groups, the investors, the innovators, the policymakers and consumers, and go the right way round. And so making the right choice the only choice for consumers is fundamentally the job of business. And that's one thing that needs to be done. And you had that lady on the other day. I don't know how long ago it was. I listened to the most incredible couple, Elvis and...
And Cressy,
oh my God.
Yes.
You know, but she is the most articulate...
I was just thinking about them as you were speaking.
Yeah, she was the most articulate person.
Wasn't she?
I'd love to meet them.
While you were just speaking, I was just in my mind going to introduce you to them.
Oh, well, you know,
literally,
I mean, were just blown away. I mean, it was amazing. And I was like, God, that woman is absolutely incredible. You know, she's everything she's worked towards. It was really, really emotional, actually, because I thought, blimey, you know, if people like that were closer to the heart of industry, well, you're the same, you know, you're getting people to not be threatened by change.
And after all of these years, talk to me about what you're thinking is next. Are you now in a place where lots of people from within business that I speak to sort of got to this place, and it's quite a place of power in terms of empowerment? Do you feel like you're going to do some of your best work now?
I have never been more excited about work. And the reason last year was a complete clusterfuck.
The best word, isn't it?
I'm sorry, I'm on a podcast. Right, yeah. Was that I thought I was going to hang up my spurs last year. and sort of just try and go and do something different. And I sort of fell out of love at some point with the idea of, am I going to be doing this for another 30 or 20 years? I'm 58.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're 58, I think, and you've been doing this for, you know, 30 years, you've got choices to make. And, you know, you have got choices to make. You've probably written a few checks your body can't pay back, misspent youth and things. And I think for me, I got to a space where I thought, I felt that it was like everyone else was doing it. Like, oh, it's time to sort of go into semi-retirement. Bill, my business partner, retired last year. And he and I were at school together and best mates, each other's best men. So I kind of, you know, I don't know. I was just sort of wandering around kind of thinking, oh, that's what we do now, isn't it? And that's the mistake I made. And I apologize to those people who I, you know, whose lives I impacted as negatively as a result, because I hired some amazing people. And then very sadly, I turned around and said, look, I'm not ready to give up. You know, and they were amazing. You know, they've been very, 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 very kind and sort of allowed me to come back. So, you know, I think that's what happened last year, to be completely candid. And now I've never enjoyed work more. I love it. And I had to just be honest with myself, right? You know, I'm going down in the saddle. I'm not, you know, I'm going to be, I love this shit. And I became quite sad because I was sitting at home going, well, everyone else playing with my train set.
Yeah.
I don't get to play.
And I, you know what? That's doing what you love, isn't it?
I think
that's
so.
The whole thing. You maybe had to taste what that could have looked like on the other side to actually come back. And you know, you deserve that. That's your path. That's your, what you've created this, and you get to see the final sunset, so to speak. You know, this is your journey. Perry, I want to talk to you forever. Tell me what you would say is your greatest low and high while you've been running Big Fish. What would you say if you won this roller coaster?
I think, look, there's been many. The greatest low actually was part of my personal life, because my business is so intertwined with our family.
Mm.
It's a family business. So, I mean, very sadly, my gorgeous, wonderful wife had breast cancer. And when she was diagnosed, my brain fell apart. You know, she didn't, she was incredible. But that, you know, Vic, I just didn't know what to do. And I remember being here and the lovely Patrick Horton, who was with me at the time, he just was the most incredible person. I just literally just broke down and I couldn't think straight at all. And I just didn't know what to do. And so that's my, you know, the business was fine. That was the lowest point in my life, even, you know, up there with losing, you know, family, et cetera. And you can't get out of bed in the morning because you just can't, you know, you're just so disconnected. And then you realize, look, this isn't doing anyone any good, certainly not me. So yeah, it's not a very good answer, but that was my low.
Yeah, no. And I think that's the reality, isn't it? When we run our businesses, when
family,
it's all encompassing, it's 360 of our lives. It's what we think about, dream about, you know, and it has massive impact. And this whole idea that we have to have separate worlds or work life or all those things.
I almost resented the business because I felt it had taken something, you know, I was like, why have I been so focused on Big Fish? You know, why have I, this is crazy. So that was the low. I think, you know, there are so many highs, too many to mention. I mean, like the biggest high, I mean, I feel like I'm sort of almost kind of saying I've got a favorite child because there are so many. I mean, and Vicky and Bill and Tim and all the people I work with that
you've been working with for so long.
Well, some of them and some new. I've got new business partner, Tim, who's great, and Mark, and all these people. So I think my greatest highs are when people join the business. I love it when they do. But I think, I suppose, Picnic, that project, is up there because it's one of the kind of most extraordinary projects I've ever worked on. And yeah, I think seeing that come to life, yeah, it's probably one of the big ones at the moment. But there'll be plenty
more.
Wow.
I love that your latest project is one of your greatest highs. Perry, I knew that you would potentially leave it to the last minute be potentially had a big night out and then had to write a bloody letter to your younger self. Do you know what I mean? So I apologise, but we've been hanging on your every word and it's time at this podcast where, you know, after listening for so long to the podcast that we're going to hand over to your letter to your younger self.
Yeah.
And I just thank you for anything that you're going to share with us.
Okay, well, that's very sweet of you. I'm going to apologise in advance because I didn't have time to write a short one.
Brilliant. So let's go in.
Yeah, and with apologies, let's do it. I am rather self-conscious about this, but hey.
You're in a safe space.
Oh God, yeah, I'm really safe. Okay. Dear 13-year-old Perry, or should I call you Dave, as I hear you've just chosen to rebrand yourself to fit in because your big brother told you you'd get your head kicked in with a name like Peregrine. Well, don't listen to him. Be proud of who you are. Stick to Perry. It's a great name, and it's your name, and it's the name your loving parents gave you to help you stand out. I promise you, you won't regret it. And ironically, naming and renaming is going to be a big part of your life. Look, I know you're not going to listen to this advice because you have the attention span of a gnat, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. First off, you're really going to struggle at school because you're not like everyone else. Your brain's wired differently to most people's, and your business studies teacher is going to humiliate you and keep calling you thicky in front of the entire class. Tell him to fuck off. You're far from thick. You just don't know it yet. It turns out that your entire career will be focused on advising business owners and entrepreneurs on how to create and grow extraordinary brands. And you're going to help them make millions of pounds in the process, so good for that. But it's hard to believe, I know, but there you go. Who'd have thought it? Look, you're going to meet an art teacher called Robin Child. He's going to open your eyes to a world of possibilities. Go to his Thursday afternoon lectures and become spellbound by his stories about how artists were motivated and why art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life. You're going to meet lots of great people at school. And two of them, Lisa Clark and Bill Barlow, are going to end up working with you and becoming your business partners. So be nice to them, because they're going to look after you and support you in your hour of need beyond your belief. But bad news, I'm afraid, you're going to fail your English A-level, because instead of writing an essay in the exam hall at the end of Marlborough High Street, your attention deficit's going to get the better of you and you're going to draw a picture of the girl sitting in front of you instead. Mum and Dad are going to be really disappointed, but don't worry. They're going to be so proud of you, because eventually it's that picture and that act that's going to get you into St. Martin's School of Art. And don't forget to spend more time with your parents and be kind to them. Never be embarrassed by them. They're the coolest people on the planet. And one day, sooner rather than you would like, they're not going to be on the end of the phone anymore. So don't delete their voicemails. Save them and listen to them when you're feeling down and you miss them. I'm going to fast forward through the early idyllic years of your life, because you're surfing 7 hours a day, you're crap jamming and bad guitar playing with Bill and all of that stuff and larging it. That's great. You're going to make lots of good choices. But listen, you're going to mess up big time on plenty of occasions. I won't spoil the surprises, because those mistakes are going to be crucial to your success. So go ahead and blunder. Don't dwell on regrets. Instead, learn from each and every cock-up. Pick yourself up and move forward as a tougher, more resilient human being. You're going to fall in love with a beautiful woman who's 1,000 times more intelligent than you, called Vic. She's going to change your life, and she's going to give you 3 incredible daughters who you will love unconditionally. Never, ever take her or them for granted. Be kind to her. And remember to make her tea every morning in the big 15-ounce blue Cornishware mug, 2 tea bags, not 1. Empty the bloody dishwasher, take the bins out, learn to cook, and make her supper at least once every week, and tell her how much you love her every day, and ensure she knows you actually mean it. Oh, and by the way, name all your girls after fonts. I'd go with Perpetua, Helvetica, and Clarendon, because even though it will drive your mother-in-law crazy, everyone will remember them, and the girls will love feeling different, even if Pep says she doesn't. And when it comes to business life, I've got way too much advice for one letter, but here go a few tips. Don't be greedy or driven by money. Use business to make a positive impact wherever you and whenever you can. Read William McDonough's essay that Pep will send you, and try to inspire those around you to do the same and to displace bad with good. Challenge conventional wisdom. Seek out curiosity and creativity, and people who you will learn from, who you will respect and admire, and will want you to succeed. Work with radiators, not drains. Give the naysayers a wide berth. You're going to start a business with Lisa, and then you're going to team up with Vicky, Bill, Tim, Mark, and countless people, too many to mention. They're all amazing. And it's going to be called Big Fish. And it's going to absorb more time than you can possibly imagine. So remember to enjoy the ride and look after those who kindly look after you. You're going to meet hundreds, if not more, extraordinary clients, all of whom will put their faith in you. Go the extra mile for them, for each and every one, because you will only succeed if they do. Reward their trust and remember how lucky you are to be invited to be part of their journey. And every time you start a project, always ask yourself, what would I do differently if I were to start again from scratch today? Because that's how progress happens. Learn to provoke and challenge without conflict or descending into pointless arguments. Be curious. Question everything apart from your capability. Earn as much as you can and then just give it all away. Oh, and buy shares in Apple. It's a great company. A bloke called Steve Jobs is going to inspire you to think differently. So go out to California and try and meet him because sadly, he passes away way too young. Always, always, always talk to strangers. Start conversations. Speak up. Push yourself. Wing it. Step out of your comfort zone because that's how you'll learn and how you're going to discover the extraordinary. Always allow ideas to be born ugly. And don't kill them off before they've had a chance to evolve and become beautiful. Don't underestimate the time it takes to make quick decisions. Spend more time sharpening your pencil than doing the drawing. And remember to always speak truth to power. Don't be bullied into doing things that you don't believe in, like changing your name to Dave or conforming to dull conventions. Don't give in to social pressure, or if you're not comfortable with doing those things, just don't do them. Plow your own furrow. And don't look at the competition. Let them do their own thing. Do yours. As soon as you become a father, you're going to become a catastrophist and a hypochondriac overnight. But the good news is that you've made it to 57, so stop bloody worrying that you're going to die. We suffer more in our imagination than we do in our reality. Things are never as bad as they seem, and they're probably never as good. But hey, if you've read this far, well done. Your attention span is clearly improving. And remember, always, think big, dive deep, swim fast, because it turns out that life is a hell of a lot shorter than we realize. And for many of those who you will come to love and care about, it's even shorter, sadly. So grab it with both hands, feast upon it until you're full to the brim, and then grab one last massive helping and go for it. Because life is bloody fantastic, even when it's not. Big hugs, Perry.
You're one of the gentlemen in my life that has inspired me profoundly, Perry. From the moment I came to you with my ugly idea and you took it and you held it so kindly and carefully, and you, in a time where I was shattered beyond belief, when I walked into that room and you did your magic, you allowed me to be born again. And I feel the fullest I've ever felt. And I will always look to the moment that you allowed, you saw what it was. And just, you're a magical human being. And I hope you know that.
Well, you're very, very kind. But I think you should take all the credit, Holly. We just did what you needed to do and what you asked us to do. And honestly, you're an amazing person, and keep doing it because you inspire all of us. And I'm so, so pleased to be able to see you again on doing so well. It's just fantastic.
And thank you for your letter. Absolutely one of the best.
Oh, I'm sure it isn't.
My goodness. Loved having you. Well, thank you, Perry.
You're very kind. Thank you so much, Holly.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.